Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
I was shocked, you know. They were always such a good team, so successful. But to do something like that, to exceed their budget?
While being over budget might not be a crime, it can disrupt workflows. With Monday.com, you and the team can be sure that you're all in sync. All the data, latest updates, files, and budgets are visible to everyone, so you won't miss a thing. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and the man behind the glass is the captain. And we would like to point out that your fantasy football team is not as good as you think.
Well, guess what my team's name is?
I beefed one.
No, it's Eat My Ass. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling your cousin.
Today we are sipping on Blackback Honey Rye by the hardworking crew at Silverback Distillery. This is rye whiskey infused with real honey liqueur. Pour it over some ice and it's smooth sipping here today in the garage, my friends. Garage grade, 4 out of 5 bottle caps. And this week's drinking was brought to us by these good friends right here. First up, we have a big cheers, mates, to David K. in Elizabethtown. He says he left his other true crime podcast for the garage and has not looked back.
And a big we like your jib to Julian in Sulphur, Louisiana.
Next, we have a friend and longtime listener, Alex, in the land of the midnight sun in Fairbanks, Alaska. Cheers to you, Alex.
Mm-hmm. And a big shout out to Elizabeth in Wichita, Kansas.
And we have Jennifer in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and also in big, beautiful Canada. We have Sherry McGeo and the whole family listening in Newcastle, Ontario, Canada. Guess what, Canada? The garage loves you so much. We are doing a Canadian garage tour in 2020. So thank you to everyone who helped with this week's beer fund. And if you would like to help us raise enough money to actually follow through on that Canadian tour, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
I am very excited to announce that we have some new merchandise in the store. We have a beer glass set. We have a hat. We have bottle openers. We have koozies. We have everything for your fall tailgating needs. Check out truecrimegarage.com and also download the Stitcher app for all of our old episodes and check our bonus episode out weekly on Stitcher Premium called Off the Record.
All right, Captain, that's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. We discussed 3 murders yesterday, and unfortunately, there will be more. Today, we start off with Neural Renfro, who was a 50-year-old millionaire. His business, Gold Coast Realty and Investment, was booming. Renfro was not out. In fact, none of his friends had any idea that he was gay. Mm. He apparently liked to hang out in the company of young men, entertaining them at his home or at his mountain cabin. On December 19th, 1982, Renfro was hosting 18-year-old John Oren Biggs, who answered an ad placed by Renfro for a live-in caretaker for his house. This was a house in a modest but nice neighborhood of Bakersfield, but this house was noted for its fortress-like bars on the windows, and neighbors said that the shades were always drawn. Anyway, Renfro and Biggs were playing pool, and Renfro made a pass at Biggs. Biggs said he let it go, but when it happened again a few minutes later, Biggs grabbed a fire poker and bludgeoned Renfro 40 times over the head. Biggs was then rifling through the house looking for cash, and then he stole Renfro's car and went and picked up a friend. This is 18-year-old William Blankenship. The two returned to the house and stole a safe, but were later very disappointed when they found the safe contained nothing of value. Now, Biggs was arrested and charged with Renfro's murder. His defense was a variation of the, quote, gay panic defense. They alleged that Renfro was a pervert, and Biggs' attack on him was prompted by Renfro's advances. It turns out, and it appears, that Nerl Renfro had a history. He, on at least three prior occasions, lured young men to his house using the ad for employment, made advances, and then actually raped one of these men. His house was found to be missing interior doorknobs. The doors required a deadbolt key to open them, so one could not always leave of their own free will once inside.
It's kind of like the Bundy method that he used in his car, but inside his house.
Renfro, it appears, may have been a violent sexual predator. Biggs was ultimately convicted for killing him, but only for voluntary manslaughter. And he served only 3.5 years, even though he had a rap sheet going back 8 years. This is going back till when he was about 11 years old.
He didn't get a double charge for manslaughter plus, you know, robbery.
My notes only state that he was convicted of voluntary manslaughter.
They might not have pressed charges if they stole a safe and there was nothing in it, though. So that's a possibility.
Well, his rap sheet going back to when he was 11, this included things like assault and battery, shooting at police, extortion, robbery, and burglary.
Wow.
So this is viewed as basically a slap on the wrist, and it did outrage many people at the time, particularly gay rights activists who believed that Biggs got off easy because Renfro was gay. But see, here's the issue again. We have a case where somebody ends up murdered, and then we have robbery and some other things that went down during the commission of that murder. We have allegations that are brought forward against the man who is now dead and unable to defend those allegations. This is a whole big messy story. And around that same time, we have William Tyack. He threatened, shot, and killed two gay neighbors after some kind of confrontation. And it appears he did so simply because they were gay.
Right. It's a hate crime, yeah.
Yeah. So this has a similar outcome. Tyack was convicted of only involuntary manslaughter of one of the men, despite having threatened to kill them and then bragging about it afterwards. One writer said of the result, quote, "This case would reinforce a national impression of Bakersfield and Kern County being a place where violence against gays is tolerated," end quote. In the wake of these verdicts, the state attorney general was convinced to take a look at whether homosexual victims of violent crime were being shortchanged in Kern County.
Well, they were for a long time in history, 60s, 70s, 80s.
It seemed that there was a contradictory history in the Kern County justice system. Some killers of gay men got light sentences, despite the law and order approach Kern County prided itself on, mm-hmm. while some well-connected, powerful gay men escaped scrutiny or got off easy despite having sex with minors. It's really a situation where you see all this going on and you have to, I mean, you can only throw your hands up in the air and go, what is going on here?
Right.
What truly is going on here? Then we have Attorney General John Vandekamp. He established a commission on racial, ethnic, religious, and minority violence. Los Angeles attorney Thomas Coleman headed up the investigation of the Biggs and the Tyack trials, in which the defendants received light sentences, allegedly because of the homosexuality of the victims. Coleman said, quote, "What you're talking about is corruption, whether the victim is gay or not. The presence of sexual orientation as a factor has in the past, at least, given the appearance of unequal treatment," end quote. After studying the situation, he established a campaign against hate violence and encouraged stiffer penalties for cases involving violence against certain groups, including gays. It was a start, but it did not address the systemic problem embodied by the Lords of Bakersfield.
Yeah, and this is going to heat up, too, because one of the activists and one of the people leading this charge for stiffer penalties is actually going to be murdered.
Marshall Jacobson was a 48-year-old millionaire real estate and criminal defense attorney in Bakersfield, and he spoke in front of the Kern County Crime Commission urging these harsher sentences for criminals who perpetrated violent crimes against homosexuals. Jacobson himself was gay and known to frequent the Bakersfield Greyhound bus station. Apparently, this was a popular meeting spot for men, and where Ed Buck had also been known to frequent. Bakersfield police knew about Jacobson and had looked into allegations of sexual misconduct made by an underage boy, but charges were never filed. Then at the bus station, he met Randy Ray Backen, who was 19 years old, and this man went on to live with him for 8 months. Jacobson provided food, lodging, and a job, including tuition for school, but required sex in return.
Yeah, he was a sugar daddy.
Backen wasn't gay, and he said later that he was disgusted by the relationship, but he needed a roof over his head. He resented Jacobson, and he broke the house rules. In fact, he skipped school 2 days in a row. When this happened, Jacobson kicked him out, and Backen left the house. He returned a week later, demanding entry into the home, and even climbing over the back fence.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went inside the unlocked sliding doors. Once inside, he stabbed Jacobson in the stomach 10 or 11 times, and then he proceeded to rob the house. He drove Jacobson's car full of stolen goods all the way to Los Angeles, and he sold the car. Then he tried to escape to Mexico, but he was turned in by a friend of Jacobson's, who he had called for help. Here, the lenient sentencing ran out. Backen got life without the possibility of parole. But again, it was a case of an older man surrounding himself with young men and one who ended up killing him.
And yeah, this is going to bring us to the year of 1998.
So depending on who you talk to, a number of years passed before any more murders occurred that seemed to have anything to do with the pattern surrounding possible members of the Lords of Bakersfield. As you said, Captain, 1998, we have Sid Sheffield, who was a prominent education and health activist in town. He was found stabbed to death in his mobile home. The murder weapon was a knife, and he was robbed. Police discovered that he was leading a secret life, one that did not go with his public image at the time. He was promiscuous, very social, and was said to have no enemies, and possibly was last seen with a young man in a cowboy hat at a local bar. This case, to this day, remains unsolved. And to be perfectly fair and transparent, no one is really sure whether it has a connection to the Lords of Bakersfield or not, but it's often brought up during those discussions.
Yeah, it's a similar situation.
This is, again, we have a tough time figuring out what cases to include and what not to include. And again, who, depending on who you talk to, that can change drastically. So let's go to 2002, because this is where things really, really start to fall apart. Okay. We have 57-year-old Bakersfield Assistant District Attorney Stephen Talzer. He had a public image of the caring do-gooder, the public servant, a good Samaritan who took a drug-addicted youth under his wing. This kid was Lance Hillis, who knew Stephen since Lance was 5 years old. His father, Chris, worked for Stephen Talzer as a district attorney investigator after he spent several years in the Bakersfield Police Department. Talzer was gay. It was considered an open secret. And he seems to have fixated on this young man, Lance, who was under the age of 18 when Talzer started grooming him, got involved with meth at the age of 16 and was not welcome at his home, at his parents' home, because he was doing drugs. Talzer took advantage of the situation and offered Lance a safe haven, a place where he could stay. At first, Lance stayed at Talzer's home for several months, but he told a friend he wasn't comfortable there. And he was there just for the food and for the clothes and for a place to sleep. Now, he would leave, but he would always end up going back to Talzer's home. This mostly when money ran out for the drugs that he wanted.
Yeah, it seemed like it was one of his only options.
Once in a while, when he left, he would take one of Talzer's cars, to which Stephen Talzer would call the police, but would never end up pressing charges for a stolen vehicle. The police knew that Talzer was spending a lot of time with this young man. When Lance finally got his own apartment, Talzer co-signed the lease, and it doesn't seem like anybody's really sure how Lance was actually paying the monthly rent, but you don't have to use much of an imagination to come up with an idea. So speculation, of course, was Talzer was paying, and he was a regular visitor to Lance's home. Talzer continued to supply Lance with food, credit cards, lodging, a car, and a friendship, such as it was.
Yeah, he was providing him with a little F and S.
Well, Lance continued into a downward drug spiral. He was stealing, he was crashing cars, and he was injecting drugs into his veins. His family was extremely anxious, among other feelings, for him to kick this drug habit. They actually wanted him sent to jail. They thought that this would be truly the only way to break the cycle of addiction that really had a hold on this guy, right? So Talzer used his assistant district attorney influence to get Lance off anytime he was charged with stuff. So Lance would just be facing rehab rather than facing jail time.
Go on, this is, I mean, it's not that far of a stretch to look at this situation and go like, but this is like sexual trafficking in a sense, you know, by enabling this person or possibly giving them the money for drugs. Maybe you're not injecting it for them, but you're basically creating the situation now that you have an addict that they're dependent on you for drugs or dependent on you for financial situations, and then you're using them for sex. I mean, that's sex trafficking.
Well, it's also believed that not only was Lance being sent to rehab because of Talzer rather than jail, but it's also believed that, like, anytime there was a chance that Lance was going to encounter a tough judge in one of these charges, that he would conveniently have the case moved to a different court. Yeah. So, again, he could just get rehab. So this happened repeatedly, to the incredible frustration of Lance's family, Whenever Lance was in rehab, Talzer was a regular visitor. Even when Lance assaulted a worker at one of the rehab facilities, Talzer had the incident buried. Chris Hillis knew Talzer for years, both in his role on the Bakersfield Police Department and at the DA's office, and because he had done extensive renovation work at Stephen Talzer's home. He was getting desperate to save his son, Lance. He had Lance arrested in an attempt to save him from his meth and heroin addictions. Already a man with a temper, who had been written up for the use of excessive force 5 times as a police officer, he lost it when he was confronted with the reality that Stephen Talzer's relationship with his son was far from that of a mentor relationship, but was really a sex for drugs and money arrangement. The Hillis family realized that Talzer had preyed upon their teenage son's desperation for drugs and abused him. Chris Hillis confronted Talzer in August 2000 and demanded to know what the obsession was with his son. This ended in a violent confrontation, which we have Chris, who ends up hitting Talzer and then calling the sheriff's department. When the responding officers arrive, he's telling them that Talzer was inappropriately involved with his son, Lance. The sheriff's department refused to file a report, rallying around the district attorney, the assistant district attorney. Talzer ended up with a black eye and nothing else. When Lance continued to be arrested for drugs, and thanks to Talzer's intervention to be sent to rehab instead of jail,
right,
the Hillis family truly felt that their hands were tied and that this man corrupted their son, and there was little, if anything, that they could possibly do about it.
Yeah, well, he corrupted their son, and now he's corrupting the system, which is consistently enabling their son.
Yeah, and because their son is an adult, and when a lot of this is going down, it gets complicated for them to step in and try to get involved or, you know, take the reins and really steer what's going on here. Now, Lance's grandfather did just that. He was a former Bakersfield police officer. His name's Don Hillis. He recommended to Lance's probation officer in January of 2001 that Lance should do 6 to 9 months in jail just to get him cleaned up. Lance's brother, a probation officer for Kern County himself, agreed to this. And multiple probation officers continually recommended jail for Lance, but Talzer continued to intervene. And once again, Lance avoided jail time. In July of 2002, Lance was enrolled in Progress House. This is a rehab facility in Sacramento. This time, Lance escaped from the rehab house. He stole a car and he crashed into a truck. Unfortunately, he died instantly during this accident. This was on August 7th, 2002. This ripped up his family. Overcome with grief and rage, Chris Hillis, Lance's father, murdered Stephen Talzer on September 13th. Talzer was found dead in his garage with a knife sticking out of his head. The Hillis family believed that if it were not for Stephen Talzer, then their son Lance would still be alive.
Yeah, initially the father denied being involved. He eventually pleads guilty to the crime, and he is hit with 10 years for involuntary manslaughter, right?
For voluntary manslaughter.
And which is going to be a little bit different because the other charges, those guys were getting about 3 years. He's going to get 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris Hillis got out of prison in 2013. He runs a drug rehabilitation facility in Bakersfield called Lance's Haven. Now, the Talzer-Hillis case brought to the forefront some of the old wounds dating back to the late 70s and early 80s, to the time when multiple murders of male predators occurred by the hands of younger victims. But now it was 2002, a different time. What was overlooked back then was recognized in 2002 as pedophilia.
Yeah.
Illegal sex with minors, and an old boy network of corruption and cronyism. that Talzer had continued to get away with using his considerable power and influence to control the life of this young man, to do him favors with big strings attached, was shocking and disturbing. And the fact that so many in positions of public service and influence looked the other way was horrifying. They didn't protect Lance Hillis. Instead, they handed him back over and over again to a predator. The case gave rise to the expose in the Californian that dredged up all the old Lords of Bakersfield tales, and people realized that much of those old legends were rooted in truth.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
I was shocked, you know? They were always such a good team. So successful. But to do something like that? To exceed their budget?
While being over budget might not be a crime, it can disrupt workflows. With Monday.com, you and the team can be sure that you're all in sync. All the data, latest updates, files, and budgets are visible to everyone, so you won't miss a thing. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
All right, cheers, everybody, and make sure you don't be a douche canoe. Go to the store page and pick up a koozie or something.
The hat,
today. The
hat is awesome. there's actually several
the hat.
There's several awesome things.
Pick up the hat.
I'm sorry, I'm just lost in this whole story. I mean, I'm like swimming through the madness of what this could be or what it completely is not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, here's the difficult thing is what was happening wasn't recognized correctly on what was actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but does that mean because of all these, basically you have the murder victim was actually victimizing somebody beforehand.
Or accused of doing so.
Right. And all those murder victims are of gay orientation? Or is it pedophilia?
Or pedophiles.
And there's a big difference. And then on top of that, just because they're of power doesn't mean they're necessarily connected.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? We're going to get to some bigger things regarding this story here in just a second, but really, truly, Captain, I feel like there's 100 different angles that you could look at this story from, and I'm not certain that any of them are the correct angle to approach it from.
There's a lot of angles that you don't want to look at this.
That's true. So,
but the major point of the story is to buy the hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Get the hat.
Get the hat.
All right. Let's get into one-time Bakersfield District Attorney Ed Jagels. Chris Willis says that he begged, those are his words, I begged Jagels in multiple phone calls and letters to take steps to rein in his second in command, which was Stephen Talzer.
What you talking about, Willis?
And get him away from his son, Lance Hillis.
Mm-hmm.
Jagel's response was that Lance is an adult, and in interviews when asked about the scandal that culminated in Talzer's murder, Jagels insisted that Talzer was like a godfather to Lance, who saw the young man as, quote, a project, and who only had Lance's best interest at heart. The district attorney for Kern County is a powerful position.
Right, but this guy also seems a little bit like a shitbag. So what he's stating, he's the prosecutor, right?
District attorney. They technically both can be prosecutors.
Okay, so the district attorney, his second in control, is saying to him, hey, you did wrong here, right? And he's saying, no, I did not do anything wrong. That's where, in these situations, it makes you wonder, is it just because of the high power they're in, or is it the money, right? Is he protecting the person because of the high power, or are they protecting the person from the money? But either way, it seems like this district attorney is a little bit of a shitbag.
Again, it goes back to all the different angles that you could look at this from, to where you could also make the argument that what Ed Jagels is saying is the truth, that Lance was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, we don't know how much he may have known or what he did know and was turning a blind eye to.
Right.
The thing here is, when this man retired after more than 25 years as a DA, Ed Jagels famously boasted that during his tenure, Kern County had the highest per capita prison commitment rate of any major California county. His mission was a law and order crime policy, sort of ironic since the Lords of Bakersfield in many cases seem to be allowed to do their thing with virtually no legal consequences, and this did occur too under his watch.
Right.
Several of them should have been prosecuted for rape, statutory rape, and crimes against children. District Attorney Ed Jagels was in office since the early 80s, and it's the opinion of many that Jagels was complicit in helping brush the Lords of Bakersfield scandal completely under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
He may not have just been looking the other way. He, as you pointed out, may have actually helped to protect some of those people that should have been prosecuted. Jagels is best known for his campaign that he initiated in the 80s to root out child sex abuse.
Right. So with all these rumors going on about the Lords of Bakersfield, instead of investigating this, they're going to go after the middle class.
Well, lower middle class citizens.
Okay.
For so-called satanic ritual child sex abuse and molestation. That
this is so bizarre.
Was not actually happening. So Jagels put 26 people, these were teachers and even parents in some situations, behind bars on felony child sexual abuse charges. This all during the 1980s. This was during the period of a national child sex abuse panic, where daycares and schools were accused of horrific abuses of kids. This was sort of a satanic panic involving children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, under Jagels, 26 convictions were secured on what is arguably zero to little evidence. Of these 26 convictions, 25 were actually eventually overturned. Kern County has paid out over $9 million in wrongful conviction settlements. A 2008 documentary called Witch Hunt, narrated by Sean Penn, details this story.
I actually believe Sean Penn was one of the producers on this as well. And to be clear, it wasn't that there was little to no evidence. What a lot of these situations were happening was that they're rounding up these kids and basically getting them to just confess to anything. But not ever coming up with the story themselves. So they coerced all these stories and all these allegations basically out of thin air.
Right. They didn't bother to go find any evidence to back up these accusations or these stories by children. And so what this leads to is all of these, well, 25 of the 26 convictions being overturned. And then in 1999, a Pulitzer Prize winning book entitled Mean Justice, A True Account of a Town's Terror, A Prosecutor's Power, and a Betrayal of Innocence exposes Jagel's tactics, including presumption of guilt, manufacturing or embellishing evidence, persuasive interrogations, prosecutorial misconduct. Despite all of this, Jagel's continued to be reelected, and Bakersfield embraced its role as the poster city for the, quote, tough on crime movement. Its mock slogan was come for vacation and leave on probation.
Well, it's better than their last slogan, come on vacation, but only if you have some money and you're of power.
So what does all of this have to do with the Lords of Bakersfield legend? Well, what's being pointed out here and has been pointed out by many is that the lock 'em up DA seems to have overlooked the activities of various businessmen, politicians, and social elite that were going on right under his nose. Mm-hmm. Many believe he was complicit in shoving the Dana Butler murder and the Glenn Fitz situation, his likely involvement in that murder, under the rug by refusing to prosecute. And investigative reports by Rolling Stone magazine stated that many Bakersfield residents concluded that Jagel's child abuse campaign was possibly intended to divert attention away from illicit sexual behavior of the city's ruling elite.
Right.
A former investigator for the DA's office under Jagel's told the magazine, Rolling Stone magazine, that the 1980s molestation trials were simply Jagel's allies among the Lords of Bakersfield covering their tracks by going after other people. Now, we should mention here that Robert Mistrell, the man that we've mentioned a lot throughout this case,
yeah,
he actually named Jagel's as one of the men who sexually abused him. I'm going to step in for a little bit and throw my own two cents in here on this my humble opinion, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, and I talked to a friend about this who agreed, we were discussing this case, and it seems like Robert Mistrell, while I believe him on some level, it seems like he has just spewed out so many names over the course of all of this. It just doesn't seem plausible that they were all sexual abusers of children. At some point, you really got to question these allegations. Now, Ed Jagel's retired from the DA's office in 2009, and he's never been prosecuted for all of the wrongful convictions he inflicted upon innocent people.
Right, which is pathetic.
So the legend of the Lords of Bakersfield, truly, it's just a vague specter of predatory alliances and abuses of power.
Mm-hmm.
To me and to others, I got to say, man, it doesn't seem that there is real, tangible, punishable ring of abusive men. It seems more like this might be a wink-wink association and a look the other way type of tolerance.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation here because, one, you know, he's naming, 150 possible predators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the average predator, I don't know the exact number, but I know it's high 200s of rough estimated victims a predator would have. So if you have 150 possible predators in that area, we'd probably see then 20,000 victims. And why aren't we having more of these victims come forward and present this? So I think, but then it's a sticky situation, no pun intended, with the Lords of Bakersfield's, because you wonder a couple things. One, is it these people in power that are using this sick fetish of pedophilia to control each other and have something on top of each other, right? Have something over the other person to be able to control them or blackmail them. Or is it just they're protecting these predators because of wealth or their position of power? So it becomes, and I would lean to the latter two, than that it's some giant group with some giant conspiracy, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, no, I think it does. And it's only because I've been, you know, wading in these weird waters for a while now and really trying to come up with an answer myself and thinking that, you know what, the more I look at this case and the more that I dive into these different avenues that go off the main road of this case here, that I think that I'm going to find my answer. Unfortunately, I didn't. Like I said, there's also other cases that some consider to be connected to this. And I may not have gone down the right road off of the main road yet to find that. But in the end, my general opinion is that, look, there was illegal activity going on. We can't deny that. We also can't deny that there were plenty of murders going on as well.
Yeah.
But there's also a situation where some people may just not have known everything that was going on or known what was at the root of a murder or at the root of this whole mess and therefore didn't take actions against any of that. You know, there's one thing to turn a blind eye to something and there's another to just be blind to it and not know what is going on. And I think in this situation, I was really going to try to avoid giving my personal opinion, but I think I've walked down that path enough where I think I got to try to give this some kind of conclusion.
At least, I was going to say, we're good. We'll just stop here.
Okay.
see you next week. Buy the hat.
Look, it's very difficult with so many characters, misdeeds, and variables to really figure out and state what was really going on in Bakersfield for all these years. Was there, in fact, an underground network hiding in the shadows and pulling strings? And were these murders, many of them still unsolved, connected to the legend of the Lords of Bakersfield? From where I sit after reviewing this whole mess, I see a name that is repeated throughout this story and a general theme that seems to follow him. This is Robert Mistrell. By his own admission and others, he had a horrible childhood. He was selling himself at a young age, trading sexual favors to men for money, drugs, and anything else to get him by.
Right.
And while, of course, I find the actions and behaviors of the men who chose to employ him as illegal, immoral, and frankly disgusting, it's very tricky for me to go as far to call those specific situations abuse. I understand he is a child and not of legal age. But to me, it somewhat appears that Robert was able to end this sex-for-hire relationship at any time with these men, and in fact did so when, with the help of another, brutally murdered and robbed one of these men and could be suspected in another case as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this story, obviously, chock full of victims and a lot of predators. Robert just might fit into both of those categories. I'm not certain. As for Glenn Fitz, the second murder that we discuss, I have to wonder if he is the outlier in this story. Was this like a budding Dean Corll situation, or is it as simple as once his wife passed and left him alone, we have a sick man that turned his home into a playground for teenagers filled with alcohol, and they simply did not prosecute because they lacked the ability to do so? right? That there wasn't something to cover this up. They just didn't have the ability to prosecute him and therefore did not bring those charges right. forward. And had Fitz not died, be it suicide or be it murder, who's to say that they wouldn't have drug him into court at some point for Dana's murder eventually? I also want to state that the double homicide committed by William Tyack, who planned, murdered, and then bragged about doing so just because two gay men were his neighbors, that today likely would be prosecuted as a hate crime. And it's very difficult to figure out if those crimes had nothing to do with the, quote, Lords of Bakersfield, or if the lack of proper punishment in what should have been a death penalty case very likely does have something to do with it. You know what I mean? It's right. It's tough to figure out if the Lords of Bakersfield are at work in some of these situations, or if it's just someone else interfering with justice for unknown reasons. What I do think that we have is, in fact, a network of men who frequented the same locations in search of similar entertainment. They lived secret lives and desired the company of young men and or boys. Now, keep in mind something very simple that we have to remind ourselves when we start to look into conspiracies, conspiracy theories, and these pedophile rings, and all these people possibly in cahoots with one another. Anytime you have a person or persons committing illegal acts, you will have those same people covering it up, whether it's they're covering it up for themselves or if they're helping someone else. And that's where it gets very difficult to truly discern what is going on in this situation and in other situations that we look at. Is, in fact, there's no doubt that there's a cover-up. It's just to what extent is that cover-up? How many people were involved? Is it just one person? Is it a whole army
right.
of predators that are out there? There's no doubt to me that most of these men very likely knew each other. Again, they frequented the same locations. They were in search of similar things. You just really have to look at this. When they all know that their behavior, in a lot of cases, is wrong and illegal.
Yeah.
And if we believe Mr. Robert Mistral, well, then they very likely formed a ring of corrupt abusers that protected one another. And if they did that, it's very hard to say what they would not have been capable of doing.
Yeah, I agree that that's a possibility. And you'd have to believe Robert on some of this stuff. But I think you'd have to back down the number of the accusations that he's probably making.
Robert Mistral was released from prison earlier this year after serving 35 years. He's now 52 years old. He's married and is hoping to start his life over again, this after getting his GED while he was incarcerated. Although he recognizes his complicity in the murder of Edwin Buck, he also recognizes that in many ways he was not fully at fault for the circumstances that led him to the murder.
Well, and I just want to be clear, in these cases that these older gentlemen are using drugs, alcohol, money, all these briberies, just because the child agreed to it, agreed to their arrangement, does not mean it's anything less than child abuse and pedophilia.
Agreed. Now, as far as the legend of the Lords of Bakersfield and the cases that we have discussed today, we have just simply an implication of a possible connection, in my opinion. And what we have here is we have Robert Price, the journalist for the Californian, who helped expose this sordid underbelly of Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
He put it in a May 2019 article that the cases had the same ingredients. Quote, a troubled and compromised young man, a persistent, much older male sponsor, and homicide.
Try the hat. Do we have any recommended reading for this week?
We do. This week we are recommending American Predator by Maureen Callahan. American Predator, the hunt for the most meticulous serial killer of the 21st century. And some of you may have guessed it, this book is about Israel Keyes. So you'll want to check that out. And you don't have to write that title down now. You can just go to our website. We have a recommended page there. You'll find a lot of other books and other recommendations for you on that page, truecrimegarage.com.
Again, thank you guys so much for listening. Thanks for joining us in the garage every week. You're our garage buddies. And until next week,
be good, be kind, and don't litter.
I was shocked, you know? They were always such a good team, so successful. But to do something like that? To exceed their budget?
While being over budget might not be a crime, it can disrupt workflows. With Monday.com, you and the team can be sure that you're all in sync. All the data, latest updates, files, and budgets are visible to everyone, so you won't miss a thing. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.